That music was The Purple Piece by Anat Cohen on her beautiful flute and from her album Poetica. The show is Sound Health. I'm your host, Sherry Edwards, and this is BBS Radio. Things are popping at BBS, a new sister station, new hosts bringing us all together. So hop on bbsradio.com to see what's happening, from politics, like big things, to fruit flies, things, creatures, and everything in between. This show is named Sound Health. The idea is sound, as in stable and reliable, and sound as anything that allows you to reach your optimal form and function. That includes health, that includes what you think, what you feel, what diseases you're exposed to, anything about your health, mental or emotional. Okay, and on this show, we attempt to bring you information that reaches the depths of your soul to the far reaches of the universe and beyond. And we hope to support you in your quest for information and enlightenment. Today on the show, we're going to talk about some of the frequencies of the universe. We're going to explore the hidden energies around us and how we can use that field of frequencies to allow ourselves to become more awake and aware. I have a few announcements first. I think there are four announcements. Okay, one of our latest projects here at the Institute of Bioacoustic Biology has been the reversal of macular degeneration. We've actually helped people reverse their symptoms, and that the doctors are just saying they don't have the disease anymore. Spontaneous remission, you know how that goes. Macular degeneration is supposedly incurable, but we used sound frequencies to reverse it with lots of people, and we put a video together for you, and that's available on our site if you'd like to view it. That's Nutrasounds, N-U-T-R-A, sounds, plural, Nutrasounds.com, or you can probably also find that on YouTube, because I know they post almost everything we do on YouTube. Another project we're doing is fibromyalgia. We finished that one. It's been very successful. We've been able to diagnose why people have fibromyalgia through the frequencies of their voice. So it seems like it's lactic acid. Their body has an inability to use lactic acid, either because they have pyruvic acid or oxygen very low, or they have too much iron. So if you have this debilitating disease, please get in touch with us. We're looking for more guinea pigs. And it's the Institute of Bioacoustic Biology at 740-698-9119. Okay? Three, many of you requested that we have Sylvia Franck back on the show, and she's agreed to do that. Thank you for your great feedback about her book, The Tree of Life, and that we were just as surprised as you to find out that she included our work with bioacoustics and sound frequencies as part of the information about the Holy Grail mysteries. And I am just tremendously honored that she named me as one of the keepers of the Holy Grail information. She was a fascinating person. We will have her back. Okay, number four. We're having a lot of fun on our Thursday night show with Vocal Profiling Live. Last week, we had callers lined up because we're doing vocal prints live on the air, and we're able to tell people what their issues are with weight management. We found four things that we're working with, and those four things can push us in a direction to help people. They're amylase, serotonin, dopamine, and norepinephrine. So jump on the archives at BBS Radio if you want to hear that show, or if you want to join us next Thursday. It's at 9 o'clock Eastern Time. I think that's the end of announcements here. Our guest today is Lynn McTaggart. She's most known for her pioneering book, The Field, The Quest for the Secret Force of the Universe, and her latest book, The Intention Experiment. We're going to talk about both of them. Welcome to the show, Lynn.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
We appreciate the fact that you're from England, and I don't know what time there.
It is about quarter to five. in the afternoon, and the sun is just starting to go down.
Well, thank you for taking the time out of your busy day to be
with us. Thank you. It's really nice to be here, as I say.
As our audience on BBS is usually very sophisticated, but I want to start with an elementary level here. Your book, The Field. Can you talk about what you mean by the term, the field?
Sure. The field is the energy field that unites us all like an invisible web. And it is caused by the and created by the energy dance that goes on between subatomic particles. All subatomic particles, which are the tiniest things in the universe, send energy back and forth like a game of basketball. And in that passing back and forth, little virtual particles get created, and they last for just less than a blink of an eye. But if you just tally the energy of just one of those exchanges, it's not very much. It's a half a watt's worth of energy. But then if you add up all of the exchanges of all the subatomic particles of all the things in all the universe, you have this absolutely unfathomable energy dance and production of energy that is like a giant supercharged backdrop in empty space sitting there and, you know, and being there all the time. It's super energy dense, so that just the energy between a cubic square or a cubic yard is probably enough to boil all the oceans of the world. So it's quite amazing. But there are two really important implications of this kind of energy field. First of all, on that tiny, that lower nethermost level, we're all connected. We're all connected to the ends of the cosmos, because energy fields like this are made from quantum waves, and waves, which are like sideways S's, go on forever. They carry on to infinity. And also, when they bump into each other, they encode information. So it's like this giant tape recorder of all the information that ever was. And so this fact that we're connected to it means that we can tap into it under certain conditions, and that, as I say, we're connected to the furthest reaches of the cosmos.
This sounds very esoteric.
Well, it is. It's the science of spirituality. Or as Dean Radin put it to me, I said, I do the science of spirituality, and he said, also the spirituality of science. And that's true. I think the esoteric traditions are finally being proven by science, and we're starting to understand what has only been intuited before.
So you're really the person who's blending this all together.
I guess so. And I guess the fact that I'm not a scientist, which is, in this situation an advantage, because scientists oftentimes talk in code. You know, they talk in math, and it's hard for them to go outside of their experimental work to really speculate as to what this all means. And so I guess that task is left to me.
We're going to talk about both of your books, but I want to know, what prompted you to write The Field? There's a lot of very personal experiences in there. I mean, mm-hmm. You can read it and know what prompted you, but what really got you to dig in and try to find a scientific basis for this?
Well, I am very scientifically based in the sense that I'm a reporter. I'm a journalist by training. I'm an investigative reporter. And so I'm used to digging and digging to find out facts. I'm a little fact gatherer, I guess. And in the course of doing a lot of work on medicine, which is from my work with What Doctors Don't Tell You, I kept seeing evidence that things like spiritual healing works. And I don't mean just anecdotal evidence. I mean good studies with all the scientific checks and balances in there. And I kept thinking to myself, well, there's something here, but if there is something here, it violates our entire idea about how the universe works. And so I want to know if anybody out there knows why something like spiritual healing would work, because it really means there's a different dimension here that we haven't really been talking about. But I wanted to approach it from science, so I started talking to scientists all around the world. And I guess it was really just a thirst for information and wanting to know this. But it started off as really an interesting bit of curiosity. And I guess before long became a life changer for me. I suddenly recognized that we are a lot more than we seem, that the paradigms that we live our life by have to be changed, and that if people do really understand how this all works, they will understand, and if they really take on board that they're connected, that we're all connected, then they will have to look at their lives in a completely different way. They'll realize they're a lot more than they thought they were. And so I think that became a really important message for me to bring.
So what you have brought is a real explanation for things like placebo and spontaneous remission?
I guess so, yeah. I mean, because all of these are evidence of consciousness being able to affect matter. And all of that really comes out of a lot of the work that was done by scientists that I recount in the field. And I think that, you know, it provides a very tidy explanation for a lot of things that we have, you know, really heretofore not understood, but had some evidence of.
Do you have any theories about the placebo effect?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I write about the placebo effect a great deal, and I write about it in the intention experiment. I think the placebo effect is just a case of intention trickery. It's telling the body that it's taking a pill, let's say, if it's a case of a drug, when it's just taking a sugar pill. But it's the body sort of, in a sense, instructing the body, it's the mind instructing the body to heal. And so the body, and I think this works because from the evidence I've looked at that's really interesting, the brain can't really, is a brilliant organ in many regards, but it can't distinguish between an action and a thought, or a pill and just the thought of a pill. So as soon as you take what you think is a pill, your body starts marshaling all of the healing mechanisms that it would if it were actually taking the pill. It's probably even better because you don't get the side effects of the drug. But you find that this occurs not only with pills, but also with operations. There have been some really interesting studies of arthritis and patients with arthritis who are given what is like a sham operation. And so half of the people are given a real operation and the other half are given the sham operation where their leg is just opened and nothing is done and then it's closed. And they found that both sets of people do really well and report being pain-free and their arthritis gone. Whereas the second group of people, nothing was done, only what they thought was being done. So there is a beautiful example of the power of thought to change things.
In looking at how people respond, do you think there's a difference between a parasympathetic responder and a sympathetic responder to this kind of placebo or spontaneous remission effect?
No, I don't think so. I think I don't know if it's been split down into actually studying this, but I think that people of all persuasions and body types, you mean sympathetic dominant versus parasympathetic dominant?
Yes.
I haven't seen any of that. I mean, I've seen so many studies of so many different kinds of people responding to placebos that I would think that it's a universal human thing that goes on. Because of this brain research, as I say, that shows athletes, when they do mental rehearsal, the same neural pathways are activated when somebody is thinking about movement as actually doing movement.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that same kind of thing of the brain not being able to distinguish between action and thought.
Well, even the emotions of it. Candace Pert has a great book, Molecules of Emotion, that points up some of this.
Yes, absolutely. And that emotions are a thing that get affected, you know, that affect the body too.
Well, my husband and I are opposites. I'm a parasympathetic responder. You know, somebody jumps out and screams boo at me, and I have a physical adrenaline reaction, and he just looks around and says, "What'd you do that for?" He has no bodily reaction at all. So that's why I was asking the question, you know, is there a difference in how people are going to receive this?
Right.
Wayne Dyer said something wonderful about your book. McTaggart presents the hard evidence for what spiritual masteries have been telling us for centuries. Why do you believe it's taken until this point for us to blend this hard evidence that you have with the spiritual evidence that you have also. Are we just now ready? Is this just a place in the universe, a time for us? Why did it take so long?
Well, I guess it is a time where our understanding of science and our equipment to study science has now caught up, in a sense, and enabled us to look down to this kind of tiny, tiny level. You know, before that, we really weren't able to do that. We just didn't have the equipment. So we couldn't peer into the universe in this, you know, in this kind of level. And so we had to rely on people's intuitive understanding of the universe. And, I mean, their intuitive understanding is brilliant because there are so many cultures, ancient cultures, whether you look at Buddhism or you look at much earlier stuff like the ancient Egyptians or, you know, native cultures like the Hawaiian Huna, so many different cultures all believe in something very akin to the zero-point field. They might call it many, many different things, but it is basically an energy field that is all-pervasive and unites everybody. So now we now have the science to catch up with all of those amazing intuitive leaps that went on, you know, sometimes centuries ago.
I don't understand why science is just now taking it on, because if you think about the brain, it's this oscillating pile of frequencies in a pot of fluid, and it sends all the signals all over your body, and it's electrical. Why wouldn't we be energy bodies? Yet science has resisted this for eons. Energy body, auric body. You know, people like Bruce Lipton and William Tiller, they've written wonderful books. Are you familiar with James Jimjeski's work?
Jimjeski, no.
Maybe? He's out of UCLA, and he has recorded the sounds of a cell, and even of cells dying. He made the statement in 04 that if we could find out what those frequencies meant, we could eradicate disease. I think that's a wonderful, wonderful idea.
I think it sounds like, I mean, it sounds like he's sort of carrying on the work of Jacques Benvenista, who I recount in my book, who came up with this, the memory of water. But from that work that he did, which I think was in the 80s, he, and the 70s, he did some work, but I think it was in the 80s. And from there, he started recording sounds, electromagnetic sounds that the cells send to each other, and realized that this was a signaling and also a kind of unique sound that was the communication mechanism going on rather than chemistry. And he did a lot of work. He's died now, sadly, but it's recounted in the field. And I think his stuff is remarkable because Benvenista was an orthodox biologist who stumbled on this and had the genius to carry on and explore it, even though it took him to a place that he really didn't want to go to. But I think what's really going on with so many of these people who are doing work like that, this, is that they recognize that, you know, the chemical information that goes on between cells is not the only information, and in fact, not the most important information. And people like Fritz Popp have recognized that there are light emissions that go on between cells, and it's a kind of global communication mechanism that is going on between from the DNA of cells. And that this information is really the most essential. And the chemical stuff is just the kind of icing on the cake. It's just the kind of crude mechanism that we see that works in the body. And it's not that that's not information, and it's not something that we should pay attention to, but it certainly isn't the only information, and it's certainly not the most important information. So if we're trying to heal somebody, to go and just kind of mess up around with chemicals, the problem is you do it at your peril, because you try to isolate chemicals in the body and just focus on them. But the body has global responses to it, and that's why people can take a drug, and instead of it just targeting that one bit, it goes and has effects all over the body.
It sounds like we're very sophisticated robots.
I think we're anything but. I think we're beings of light, and we're information carriers, and we are beaming and sending everything back and forth to our environment at every moment. We are in We're transmitting and receiving at every moment. So we're more like transducers and senders of information. We're like a television set and a television station all at the same time.
Well, that's very mechanical sounding.
Well, it is, except that you've got information. Maybe the mechanism is mechanical, but the information is not. And I think that the fact that we can carry such information and transmit so much information, I think what's amazing, too, is that it's kind of hard to say where we end and where the rest of the universe begins now with this new information, because some of the most forward-thinking neuroscientists are believing is that higher cognitive function isn't just stored in this brain, you know, that all the information isn't just in our brains to be tapped, and there's no central computer, that we are decentralized, and moreover, a lot of information is coming from the outside. So there is a school of thought that things like memory are out in the field, and that we access our memories through a transducer, which is our brains, rather than encapsulating it in our mind, in our brain.
Do you have any idea where this originating energy that animates us comes from?
That's a really good question. No, I don't. All I can say is, I guess it's, you know, where did the field come from? It is the field, but where did that come from? I don't know. Was it from the Big Bang? Some people say so. I don't know.
I just wonder, how do we jump in and how do we get turned on?
We are turned on already. We are turned on. But the only thing that we have to know how to do is then access this extra information that we have at our disposal all the time. And the only thing that separates us from, say, a master of intention is practice and certain techniques. And those were some of the techniques that I looked at in the intention experiment. Aside from looking at the science, I also spoke to intention masters, Qigong masters, master healers, Buddhist monks, and tried to find out what their common techniques were, what were techniques common to all of them, and then to distill from that a simple program that everybody could use. And that's what I've put in the intention experiment. And I call it powering up, because people always assume that when you get into a meditative state and you're trying to calm and focus the mind, that the brain slows down. But actually what goes on in these intention masters is that when they are trying to send intention, their brain actually speeds up to a very, very rapid state. It's called a gamma state, and it's much faster than ordinary waking consciousness. It's like a brain that is focusing with peak attention. You are focusing with every pore of your body. And so those are some of the focusing techniques that I try to help people with, to really get into the state of incredible focus, where they also drop their sense of separation, their sense of ego, and they, in a sense, merge with the field.
So the field is information about what it is, and the intention experiment is how to use it and how to do it.
Yeah, that's a nice, neat way of encapsulating it. And I guess the field is the overarching theory, and it looks at how all of that evidence, shown in lots of different ways, ESP, et cetera, works into this whole overall theory. And then the intention experiment is also the more recent evidence about, and it really focuses on the one aspect, which is the real implications of the field, which were that consciousness is an energy that affects physical matter. From that, I wanted to really see, okay, what can we do with this? What's the practical thing to do with this? You know, what can we use intention for? And how powerful are we as a collective in using intention? You know, I wanted to know, you know, can you fly with your thoughts? Can you help your kids pass math with your thoughts? Or, you know, more importantly, can you do something to affect and change and lower the vast catalog of suffering on the planet with your thoughts, and particularly your thoughts as a group? And that was really what I was, you know, particularly interested in. And that's why I set up what are worldwide intention experiments, where we are working with scientists and actually running experiments with the readers of my book. The Intention Experiment is really a book without an ending because my readers really are helping me to finish it. I've invited, not the book itself is both the science of intention and also the practical powering up program, but it's also an invitation for people to come online and come and do intention experiments with us.
If we put 10 people up on the top of our building and we pushed them off one by one and only one of them flew in the wild blue sky, science would say that doesn't count because it's an aberration. And so that's a likely idea of these things that are happening, ESP and those kinds of things you're talking about. Science doesn't find it repeatable.
Well, but that's what we've been trying to do, for instance, with our intention experiments. We don't run them once. We run them a number of times, and we run them under different conditions. So some of the ones that I've been running, I've run in front of conferences that I speak in front of, and I've run it on the internet in front of readers, and then I'll run it somewhere else. So each intention experiment we run has been three or four times. And that kind of repeatability starts making the case for something.
I love some of the titles of the chapters in your book.
Light, oh, well, thank you.
Light in the Darkness, The Sea of Light, Beings of Light, The Language of the Cell, Resonating with the World. Tell people how they can get your book.
Well, they can come on Amazon or they can go to their local bookstore for both The Field and The Intention Experiment. And The Field, I just updated with a new preface. That's just come out. And The Intention Experiment has just come out in paperback. So both should be widely available all over the place. And if you can't get it anywhere and you don't have access to Amazon, you can also come on our websites, which are www.livingthefield.com. or www.theintentionexperiment.com, and, you know, order one from us as well.
I have a little review here from Amazon. It says about The Field, inspirational. Taggart has intelligently and effectively provided a missing link between science and spirituality. The Field offers a glimpse into the wonders of our universe and humankind's relevance in it. It's a great book, an easy read. Other
That's
question
nice.
Here. How do you get to people's self-belief? You know, The Secret, great movie, tells people putting in your head what you want and, you know, you can have it. But sometimes people don't even know what they want. How do you get them to the core of what's real for them?
Well, I think that, first of all, I think that they have to learn about conscious living. I mean, this is some of the work that we do with Living the Field, and these are this kind of seminars that I run, and I'll be working and coming to the States a number of times this year, and I have four seminars planned all around America, Chicago, Los Angeles, Portland, and Boston this year, and that's all up on our website for anyone who is interested. And I'm also coming to Dallas in the end of February at the Crossings, and also in Austin and Dallas in just that end of February, I think it's February 27th, at the Unity Church there. And the kinds of seminars I run, first of all, try to help people get to the point of understanding that they're all one. And then secondly, get to the point of working on conscious living. And so desires perhaps come a little bit further than, I want a bigger car, you know, I want more for me. So I think I think what is the most important thing is getting to a state of really understanding your place in the new science. You know, if you're all connected, we are all connected, that changes the whole ball game, because every single societal structure of ours is based on an idea that we're separate. You know, when you go to work and you go to your business, you think of yourself as being separate and competitive from everyone else. You're even separate and competitive with the people you work with. And the same thing with the educational model. It's based on honoring the individual and separation and competition. And, you know, your town is all about having more from your neighbors and bigger and better. And so that kind of model is what really, really defines us. But if we look at another kind of model, that would, first of all, help us define what we want and who we are. In terms of what people want, I really love Dr. John Diamond's work. He's the guy who really developed behavioral kinesiology first. And he's a brilliant man, and he uses this word, he's a good friend too, he uses this word cantillation, and it means the thing you do that puts you in touch with the divine. What makes you, what really turns on your lights? You know, what makes you feel the transcendent? And I think finding that, the thing that you were put on this earth to do, the thing you were born to do, will end up superseding anything. And I think if people can work on that rather than I want a bigger car or I want a necklace or I want, I think that from everything else, that will flow.
In your seminars, do you help people control their healing field too?
I teach people how to use intention for things like healing. I teach them also about getting past the negative intention that tends to block their positive intentions. So I try to help them understand that negative intention is just as powerful, and that negative intention is oftentimes manifested from unconscious intention. You know, there are many studies of people, say, alcoholics. There was a prayer study that showed that the alcoholics did a lot worse when the people were praying for them. And that could be a case of tainted love, because a lot of people have real mixed feelings towards alcoholics. You know, sometimes they want them to get better, but a lot of times they want them to die, because it's pretty awful to live with an alcoholic. Or it could well be that they don't want them to stop drinking because they're also a drinker. So, you know, you have to learn how to search yourself to find out what your real intentions are. So that's another thing that we work on.
How long is your workshops going to be?
A weekend.
A weekend, so like a Friday, Saturday, Sunday? Or?
Yeah, Friday night, Saturday, Sunday, Sunday half day.
Okay, is this lecture, is it individual breakout, is it experiential? What can people expect?
They can expect experiential. It's part lecture and understanding. It's also part experiential. So people come out of it, I hope they come out of it with a sense that they are a lot more than they thought they were, and also with tools. That they come out with tools. They learn how to relate in a different way. They begin to learn how to do a number of things in their lives in a different way. They begin to understand exactly what to do with intention, what intention actually is, and how to use it, how to really use it.
When you wrote The Field, did you ever think it was going to take off like wildfire like it did?
No, I didn't even think about it. I just thought about hitting my deadline. I write about this in the new preface. I was really panicked. I didn't think I was going to be able to finish it. I felt I had really bit off much more than I could chew. And I tell a very funny story in the preface about, I mean, not so funny, the initial part of it, which was at my mother's funeral. I was at her house clearing out her bedroom and clearing out her stuff. She was in Florida. I'd flown over with my family from London, where I live. And in the process of doing that, I found my letters home from college. And I sat down to read, and I opened one. And most of them were a kind of, you know, tacit, you know, they were an attempt to convince my parents of the soundness of their investment in sending me to college. And one of them said, you know, yesterday I learned tennis, and today I'm going to learn astronomy. And I killed myself laughing at that moment, because I remembered the person I was and I remember what I really meant by that, which was, today I'm going to learn all of astronomy. In other words, I'm going to take this all on in one gulp. And my mother would have also died laughing, because I think she was quite invested in that upstart young person I was and fairly overconfident young person. But I had to laugh, and that became my husband and I's catchphrase for doing The Field, because every so often I would say, okay, today I'm going to learn astronomy, because it felt like I had taken off on so much and that I really was so ill-equipped to do this. And I think for many, many months, I walked around in a fog, ignoring my children, ignoring my husband, and walking into walls, trying to figure out how this all fit. And we would have nightly discussions talking, you know, very esoteric things like, you know, if I'm not looking, does the universe disappear? Those kinds of questions. And I put it to the scientists, and I engaged in all kinds of Socratic dialogues with them, trying to work out how this all worked out. And eventually, one day, I can just say, one day, it just started working. You know, from not working, it started working, and I suddenly saw it. And I suddenly started writing faster than I could put it down. And it was quite an amazing and heady experience for me, because it almost felt like these were not my words, and that I did, you know, they were coming from someplace either so deep inside me or from someplace outside of me, in a sense. But I was really feeling like they were kind of being downloaded. It was really amazing experience.
I've been there. It's indescribable.
It was indescribable. Very, very strange. But suddenly it started working.
I'd like to talk a bit about your newsletter and then come back to the intention experiment. I've read some of the postings on your What Doctors Don't Tell You, and actually I've posted a few things. Can you describe what that is for people and what information is there?
Sure. What Doctors Don't Tell You is a monthly newsletter and a kind of information service on healing and health. And we look at conventional medicine about what works and what doesn't work. I do it with my husband, who's also a journalist, Brian Hubbard, and we study and scour the medical literature as journalists, and we have a team of others who do the same, and we look at all the kinds of conventional treatments for every possible illness under the sun, and look at what also works in alternative medicine. So in the main, conventional medicine is ill-proven and dangerous, and in the main, alternatives have a better track record and more evidence of working. But there are some times when conventional medicine does have a good solution, like emergency medicine. Brilliant. Conventional medicine, you know, absolutely excels at that. And you know, if I get run over tomorrow by a bus, I want the best of high-tech medicine to glue me back together again. I don't want homeopathy. And the same thing with alternative medicine. There are times when it's inappropriate and unproven. So we try to look at all of that, and we provide a lot of information. We have weekly e-news on all of our sites. That one is www.wddty.com, for whatdoctorsdonttellyou.com. And it's very lively, and we have loads of people getting all kinds of angry because of what we do, a lot of the conventional voices. So it's quite fun. We have a good time with it, and we're very gratified to see a lot of the people that, you know, write to us, who tell us that because of us, they, you know, they didn't have that operation and it saved their leg or something like that, or they use some alternative treatment and they're all better now. So it's quite gratifying.
And lots of information. How can people get a copy of your newsletter?
They can just go onto our website and order one. And there are also we've got about 25 books. Everything from What Vets Don't Tell You about medicine for animals and dogs and cats and other domestic animals, to all kinds of information about, you know, we've got books on vaccines and books on health, a variety of health things and longevity. We've got books on depression and heart and individual problems like cancer. So people can also get this stuff in downloads now. So if they're, you can get it in hard copy or download. So they just need to visit our site, www.wddty.com, and they'll see all the plethora of information.
A lot of our people are interested in vaccinations. What do you post about that?
Oh, gosh. Well, it's a favorite discussion of mine. I edited a book called The Vaccination Bible, and it looked at all the evidence about all the individual vaccines. So we have a lot of material about it. I mean, in the main, just to summarize it in a sentence or two, vaccination is an ill-proven and an ill-conceived idea. And there is enormous amount of evidence showing that this stuff causes harm. So I really encourage anyone who is considering vaccinating their child to read our book, The Vaccination Bible, because it has a litany of information, scientific evidence, demonstrating that in the main, they're ill-conceived ideas, and that of course, some vaccinations are worse than others, some are less proven than others, but there's a lot of evidence against all the vaccinations.
What are some of the other ill-proven and dangerous things that you write about?
Gosh, hard to start. I could just go run through the litany of things, everything from screening tests. I mean, some of our stories that we're handling most recently are screening and scanning with CAT CT scanning, and how that delivers the same power of radiation as one of the bombs in Hiroshima. And that from a doctor, that from a prominent radiologist, he has said this, admitted this. That's one of our recent ones. Another recent one is looking at the whole theory behind Prozac is based on the whole idea of serotonin inhibition. And that's been the whole platform in which this whole level of antidepressants have worked. And we're finding that platform itself was not true. So that's the kind of stuff that we try to expose. We look at that. But in the main, I mean, what we look at is procedures with no evidence. I mean, in the main, I think a lot of procedures have been adopted without evidence to show that they work. And then once they're tried on millions, then they oftentimes go back and look at epidemiological evidence and go, whoop, you know, maybe this wasn't such a great idea. So many of the screening tests aren't that accurate. You know, I'm doing huge generalizations here because this is a big subject. I mean, I wrote a big book called What Doctors Don't Tell You as well, which looks at all of this and is still out. But if you want to sort of summarize, you know, a lot of the screening tests like mammograms, et cetera, have poor track records for being that specific. A lot of the theories behind catching things early and trying to do those kinds of, you know, tests ahead of time are, you know, again, ill-founded. Many, many of the drugs, every week, and this is from the medical literature, just expose so much evidence of and catalog of disaster. I think modern medicine has now become the number one killer in the West. More people die from drugs, correctly prescribed drugs, then die from cancer, stroke, or heart attack, the other three killers in the West. It's got to the point where we really understand the drugs don't work. The whole medical model for using drugs, as I was talking about early, just doesn't work.
That's incredible. There's a case here in New Jersey where they forced parents to get their children vaccinated at gunpoint, and there was dogs there, and some of these parents didn't know they could opt out of that. The court mandated, and they have mandated the papillomavirus in Texas for all school-age girls. I think that's horrid.
It is horrid because it's forcing children to be a vehicle to prevent sexually transmitted diseases, whether or not they are sexually active. You know, they do that with the hepatitis B vaccine, too, in the States. You can opt out. You know, an important thing for every parent is to read and read material. There are different kinds of ways of opting out in every state. Some states are more rigid than others. All states have a religious opt-out. So if you have a religion or you can join a religion that doesn't believe in vaccination, you will be protected. You can opt out for medical reasons, and you can opt out in some states for philosophical reasons. So it's very important to check this out and not to be bullied and not to allow the kind of bullying. But unfortunately, it's getting to the point where they are putting guns to people's heads because people more and more recognize the drugs don't work.
Literally, they're putting guns to people's heads.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
We have about 10 minutes left. I want you to fill that time with all of the wonderful stuff about your book, The Intention Experiment, and how people can get involved.
Wonderful. Well, The Intention Experiment, as I mentioned earlier, is a book with an ongoing experiment attached to it. So it's a living book. And so what I invite my readers to do is to come online periodically at our site, www.theintentionexperiment.com, and to participate in these experiments. Now, we've run a bunch of them last year. I worked with the University of Arizona and Dr. Gary Schwartz, and we wanted to start off with very, very basic effects because, you know, we were doing something that had never been tried before. So we decided we wanted to see if we could affect the light emissions of a leaf. Now, this is, you know, a very subtle thing that goes on. All living things emit a tiny current of light. So we figured if we had any effect at all, it would show up here. So we had, at my first intention experiment, it was at our conference in London, and we had 400 people there, and we asked them to send an intention to one of two leaves. The scientists did not know which one we were sending to, and we just sent it for 10 minutes to make the leaf increase the light. So our intention was to make the leaf glow and glow. The scientists afterward then did photographs of the leaves with highly sensitive equipment that can capture this light. They also counted the light photon by photon. And afterwards, when we unblinded the study, they found out that the leaf that we sent intention was actually glowing in these special pictures. Not sent intention was dark. So we repeated it over the internet with 7,000 people. We had we've done it in other groups around the world, and we again had effects each time. Then we moved on to these amazing studies, seeing if we could do something practical, like make plants grow faster. So we started out with 4 sets of seeds, and I did this from Australia for the first time. Remember, the seeds are back at Tucson at the University of Arizona. And we sent intention to 1 of 4 sets of seeds. And the University of Arizona planted all 4 sets, and we found out that, yes, we had an effect. The seeds sent intention grew faster than the others. So then we tried it from New York. We tried it from South Carolina. We tried it over the internet with thousands of people from lots of different countries. And each time we had a big effect.
So
then we found with the healers, there was a group of healers in South Carolina who participated in one time. I had about 500 healers. And they had the biggest effect of all. The seeds grew actually twice as high as the controls. So there was an amazing result. We did similar things, changing the cluster structure of water last winter. This past winter, in December and January, we ended up with a couple of studies showing that we can change certain light emissions and cluster structures of water, which is the first step toward trying to use thought to change pollution. So that was with Dr. Konstantin Korotkov, who is a Russian physicist.
Mm-hmm.
So now we're moving on to really exciting experiments this year. We've got one planned for March 15th, so I want everybody to put that number down. I believe it's March 15th. We're going to be trying a violence experiment where we send intention to lowering violence in a particular area. So we're working on that, and we've been talking with Deepak Chopra, who's very interested in having us work with his Alliance for New Humanity to do some violent studies too. And then we are working on, Dr. Gary Schwartz and I are building a mini world, like an ecosphere, and we are asking people to send an intention to this ecosphere. It'll be a little enclosed glass globe, like a mini world, with plants and primitive animals inside. And we're going to send an intention to lower the temperature. And if we can do that, that will have a remarkable effect. That will have remarkable implications. And then we're also working with Rustam Roy at Arizona State University, who's one of the world's experts on water, and we're going to send intention to try to alter the bacterial content of water. And if we can do that, once again, that will have enormous implications on the ability of thought to clean up polluted water. So we've got a lot of really interesting ones planned this year.
Kind of a new way to rule, a new old way to rule the world.
Well, it's a way to show that people aren't so powerless. I think people do feel that there's so much going on with global warming and things that they can't, and poverty that they can't affect. And so this is a way for people to get united. On our website, every so often, it doesn't cost anything. It doesn't take much time. It's only 10 minutes. And just to get people together in a global community to send an intention and to see if, you know, if we can do things with our thoughts and we can unite as collective mind.
So people don't have to come to a seminar to do this. They can do it right from the website?
Oh, yeah. I run them at our seminars, too. But for attention experiments, people can just come on the website. Just follow the website, and it will tell you when the next intention experiment is. We're putting it up this week. It'll be, I believe it's March 15th, and we'll have a countdown, which will tell people how many days, minutes, and hours till the next intention experiment. And they should just note it down. It's usually always on a Saturday. Just note it down and spend, and it's almost always 5 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time. Remember, I live in the U.K., so we go by that. And that usually means noontime, East Coast, 9 o'clock in the morning, West Coast. So I usually try to make it a time that's friendly for people around the world, because we have people participating from 80 countries around the world. My books are translated into many, many languages. And the last time we did an intention experiment, we had people from everywhere, from Japan, China, Malaysia, South America, all over the world.
Is this a form of meditation?
It is a form of meditation, but it's an advanced meditation in the sense that when people participate in intention experiments, I give them a mini version. First of all, I suggest they read my book because they'll get all of the information. But I also give them a mini version of Powering Up, and that helps. It's kind of a meditation plus a mind focus, but it's many other things. It's creating a certain space. It's creating a certain other mind states, other emotional states, getting rid of the ego, a number of things like that.
And you can get the intention experiment at Amazon or by getting in touch with your website?
Either way, people in America can just pick it up via Amazon these days.
And your website again?
Is www.theintentionexperiment.com.
We have a little audience here where we are, and a very interesting question was just handed to me.
Sure.
What happens to our energy when you die, and do you believe in genetic memory?
That's very interesting. Okay. I believe, you know, again, I can't tell you this with any certainty, but I believe that what happens is that we, our energy maintains, and that we simply, in a sense, decouple from our body and enter the field in full energy. Now, the reason I believe this is the enormous evidence for near-death experiences, which are being cataloged by people like Pim Lommel, who's a Dutch cardiologist, and the evidence with coma victims, when supposedly the brain, the computer, central computer, is unplugged, and yet they have full awareness of everything that's gone on. So that would suggest that mind and awareness are outside the brain. So I believe that energy, that awareness carries on in some form. Now, in terms of genetic memory, yeah, I think there is some sort of interesting genetic memory that goes on. And I'll leave you with one very interesting anecdote, which is my youngest daughter, who's adopted and who's Russian, demonstrates Russians have a thing they do, it's a custom, of giving presents all the time. And Anya, without any contact with Russian people, has this. She will, even as a little kid, she would take one of my husband's ties, wrap it up, and give it back to him as a present. And so she has so many aspects of her that are so Russian that I would think that there might be something like a genetic memory there. And that would make sense because it's, in a sense, a morphic field. Mm-hmm. And it's an energy field that carries on through space and time. So she's just tapping into the field then.
And one last question. How do you think your books are going to change people's reality, change the world?
Well, I hope that the living experiment, the intention experiment, will demonstrate to people that one good thought is all it takes to change the world, that thought itself can change the world. I am told that a lot of people understand and have been given a sense of viability and a sense of proof that they were needing through the book. So I'm hoping that my book will bridge the gap between science and spirit, and give people that kind of hope, and make people understand they're more than a lonely person on a lonely universe.
Oh, a nice ending point, but I do have lots more questions, but we are out of time. Thank you for being with us, Lynn McTaggart, author of The Field and the Intention Experience, Intention Experiment, go experience it on her website. And we'll talk to you again next week. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.